The UFO phenomenon, either we like it or not, is already very much part of our reality.
I've been on panels with military people who, you know, claim that they've seen the aliens buzzing our missile silos.
Shiny concentric circles that caused a compass needle to spin and spin.
They had very large eyes, and, you know, I found their stare extremely difficult to bear.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the show. I'm Martin Willis, your host. Michael Lauk will be joining us in a moment. From here on out, we are going to be broadcasting before we actually post the podcast. We're trying to entice people to get on the chat site and do some interaction with us. So we'll be broadcasting at 8 p.m. EST, that is 12 Greenwich Mean Time, and it's on all1broadcast.com. That's all the number one broadcast.com. And after that show, we will post our podcast, and that's every Friday evening. I'm hoping to see some of our listeners in the chat room. It was a lot of fun last week. And Michael, you might actually be in there this week, yes?
Yeah, there's a good chance of it. Last week, I was on vacation, and I was so far out of contact with the real world, I couldn't even get a cell phone signal. It was driving me crazy.
Great. Great. Well, don't forget to check out our website, which is podcastufo.com. You can access our Facebook page from there. Our guest today, Mac Maloney, will be a guest star on the forum to answer all your questions from July 20th to July 23rd. That's a week from when you'll be hearing this. After the news, but before Mac Maloney, we're going to be talking with North Carolina MUFON's Israel Curiel. Great guy. So, Michael, how was the vacation overall?
I was cut off from everything at a lake in the summer, and I hate the sun and the water and being cut off. So
you hate
there's a lot of drinking.
You hate the sun and the water?
I hate the sun and the water.
Maybe you should go to like Mars or something.
I'm like the world's worst Indian, but I hate the sun and the water.
Oh, that's right. You have a little Native American thing.
Yeah,
right?
I do. Yes, I do. Yeah. I'm a moon person. I like the night and all that kind of good stuff. But yeah, it was the kids had fun. That's what's important, right?
Yeah, I suppose. Yeah. So what's going on with the news?
Well, Martin, this week we have a couple of 4th of July sightings, some astronomy news, and a great new app for UFO researchers. First, though, I'd just like to take a brief moment to welcome our new listeners joining us through the all1broadcasting.com website. I hope you all enjoy the show and invite all the listeners, new and old, to again join us at podcastufo.com, where we have blog posts, show notes with links to all the media coverage of the stories we're going to cover, and, of course, those forums. Last week was Independence Day in the United States, and for our international listeners, we celebrate the birth of our nation in America with fireworks displays, so there were many eyes towards the sky in the early evening throughout the weekend. News 92 FM in Houston, Texas reported on multiple sightings in the state, highlighting the experience of a Cyprus family. Their coverage was fair and without ridicule. The station actually gleaned their information from MUFON reports and passed along MUFON contact information to listeners, as well as soliciting reports for the station itself. Meanwhile, Daniel Lai, the editor of the Patch website for Dearborn, Michigan, is asking readers if they spotted the UFO reported by a local man. His report, however, was not filed with MUFON, but it does include video.
Yes, I was out, you know, watching the fireworks, and I saw Chinese lanterns everywhere. I can understand there must have been a lot of sighting reports, people seeing those. But I did look at the video and the pictures, and this is definitely not a Chinese lantern. I don't know exactly what it is, but
the three lights were too rigid, it seemed, for Chinese lanterns. Now, I didn't see a single Chinese lantern entire 4th of July. No.
Yeah, but you were in some remote place in the middle of nowhere, right?
Well, I mean, I was in Lake of the Ozarks, Missouri, which is a huge lake and resort area not too far from like Branson. Even though it's cut off, it's a very crowded area. And fireworks are legal as hell there. So everything was blowing up. But maybe that's why we just didn't need Chinese lanterns. But I didn't see – because I even remember thinking – I was like, wow, I didn't, you know. For all these reports, I haven't seen a single one of these. I didn't even see anywhere to buy them.
Well, you know, I actually took video of one from my cell camera because I just wanted to see what it would look like. And you could almost pass it off. You really could.
The Discovery Channel website brings us a report of several amazingly powerful cosmic bursts that were detected by the Parkes Radio Telescope in New South Wales, Australia. The events had more energy than our sun would produce in 3,000 centuries, even though they only lasted a few milliseconds, and seem to have originated outside of our galaxy. They may represent some new type of event in the universe. It is also possible that the bursts are caused by some known event, such as a supernova.
If we had something like that happen, sort of cosmically close to us, we'd be in big trouble.
We'd never know.
Yeah, absolutely.
You would never know.
It'd be like a little tss, and that's it.
All right. And finally this week, we have a great app for anyone interested in searching through the British Ministry of Defence UFO files. The UK UFO Files app, which is only 99 cents in the Apple App Store, allows you to search through the files on your iPhone, iPad, or iPod Touch. As far as we can tell, there's not an Android version yet, but you can go directly to the U.S. App Store download of the UK UFO files through the link in our show notes. There is also a British version of this, of course. Unfortunately, I couldn't convince my American computer to go to the British iTunes App Store to get that link. So our European friends are just going to have to look for themselves.
Yeah.
And Martin, what do you think about this and some of the other digital resources that are out there for those interested in the UFO field?
It's really great, but it's only as great as the information that they provide. You know, I mean, what's the old saying? Garbage in, garbage out. You know, I mean, as long as it's the right stuff that people can access, I think it's absolutely fantastic. You know, and maybe it'll get more people interested in, you know, the field to begin with, and, you know, maybe that would produce more answers down the line. What do you think?
I think even the garbage sometimes, if it's government garbage, is at least useful in saying, you know, here's the official story, or here's where, you know, X incident was skipped, or, you know, many other things. There's been so many stories that have come out of those UK files. I think anything that makes them a little bit easier to sift through is a good deal. But you're right. A lot of it could be garbage, and of course they're keeping the good stuff to themselves.
Absolutely. All right, Michael. So we're running tight on time here. Thanks a lot, and we'll catch up with you next week.
Yeah, and hopefully I'll be seeing everybody in the chat rooms in just a couple seconds.
If you missed us this week in the chat room, then you know to get on it next week. Thanks, Michael.
All right, thank you.
Israel Curiel, how are you, Israel?
Good, doing good.
And you are from MUFON, and you're a field investigator down here.
I'm a field investigator, but I'm also the North Carolina MUFON Public Relations Director. So I run the website, set up meetings across the state.
And what is what's the general activity like with your organization here?
As far as filing reports?
No, is there a lot of participation? Is there a lot of people involved, or is it?
At any one time, we have somewhere between eight and 10 investigators in the state.
Yeah.
When I joined the organization, we were looking at the average traffic per month was 3 to 4 cases a month.
Yeah.
Now we're closer to 17 to 18 cases a month. So it's every 48 hours I get, on average, a new case.
Really? Wow.
So we stay very busy.
And how many investigators are there?
There's, I believe right now we have 8.
That's a lot of work for 8 people, isn't it?
Well, see, and you know, that's kind of a misnomer how much activity we get, because that doesn't include the phone calls we get directly, or the emails we get directly, the comments that people post on the website, where they don't really want it filed anywhere.
Yeah.
But like at a meeting like this, I'll have many, many people walk up to me and say, hey, you know, I really don't want this in a database somewhere, but let me tell you about my sighting or experience.
That does happen a lot, doesn't it?
It does. You know, here this is only an estimate, but I believe that we would get less than 1% of actual UFO sightings.
I've said the quote before that I believe that nationally, you know, maybe I've never said the quote on the podcast, but in talking with people, that it's only a guess and speculation that I think about 10% of the reports are reported. Do you think it's lower than that yourself?
Oh, yeah, no, it's 1%, if not even
really
less. It's really that much.
So if we could say this worldwide, that there's 30,000 reports every year. Do you think that's 1%?
Yeah, that's about 1%. I mean, I would probably even say less than 1%.
So you're saying there could be like million
actual sightings? Yes,
actual sightings.
And I have a great
pretty busy skies.
It is. It is very, very busy skies. I know that's kind of audacious to say that, but the perfect way that I like to prove to most people how busy the skies are is ask your own family. Ask your own family, your friends, your colleagues, and outright, have you ever had a UFO sighting?
Yeah.
Because in my experience is that family members will have had seen UFOs or had some anomalous sighting, but they're not going to share it. Somebody has to actually ask them about it before they're willing to offer up their experiences.
That's right. Do you mind if I tell an experience so I can tell the audience at the same
time
that was shared by a family member recently to me? This family member was going through a mountain pass. There was cars in front, in, and back. All the cars stalled all of a sudden. All the cars stalled. They pulled off to the side of the road. Everybody's looking at each other. They get out, pull up the hoods, look at the engines. All of a sudden, now this guy never even knew what a UFO was or anything, but he's saying all of a sudden a cigar-shaped cylinder floated right over them. One girl screamed, I guess, had windows and everything, and everybody was just staring at it with their mouth open, and it made no noise at all. And floated through the mountain pass and then just kept going. One guy finally jumped into his car, turned the key, and every single car started right back up and they all drove away. Isn't that something? I mean, just out of a family member's mouth that all of a sudden you talk about interest in UFOs and there you go.
Then I had to share my family a story. I didn't actually find out this family story until 1998. But in 91, I have an uncle who's a dentist and a professor of dentistry at a large university inside Mexico City, and he was on the highway along with several other cars between a mountainous area, and they saw these white orbs come over the highway and cross over the mountain range. And he said, I mean, all the cars around him, I mean, people slowed down. They're looking at this very bright orb just crossing the sky in the middle of the day.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, you know, I have no idea what it was. I don't want to speculate what it was,
but
I don't want anybody to know because, I mean, obviously, being a professor, he's very concerned about, you know, his position.
Yeah, yeah. So, like you said, just poke around in your own family. You can probably hear something.
It has been my experience that is the case.
That's great. Now, what got you involved in UFOs to begin with?
Actually, that's a really bad story, and I'll share why.
Okay.
When I was 17 years old, I had a friend in high school. You know, it was near the end of the year. I'd known her all year long. And she said, Israel, I want to share something with you. And she said that she grew up on a farm in Kansas. And that one day her and her mom were chased through a field by a UFO. And it scared her and her mom so much that they jumped in the truck, the family truck. They abandoned the farm, actually abandoned the husband, and never went back to Kansas.
You mean they just got in and just drove away?
They left. And
wow. I've wanted to do that before, but never over a UFO.
Well, unfortunately, I'm 17 years old, and number one, I thought, okay, you're crazy. And number two, you just scared the hell out of me.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, I never spoke to her again. She scared me so much.
Really? Wow.
That same summer, I found the book Communion, which I'm assuming a lot of your readers know about. And funny enough, here 20-some years later, I'm a field investigator, and I cannot tell you how terrible I feel about having not spoken to her again after she shared her story with me.
Yeah, and can you ever get a hold of her?
I've actually looked her up, but she moved out of state, so I don't know what her last name would be.
Yeah, yeah. Well, anyway, it's been a real pleasure meeting you. And I noticed a lot of people here know you. Everybody's walking up to you. So
I'll be real honest. I have been very active in trying to, what's the right term, socialize or just be more active in all of state North Carolina. We've traveled to 5 or 6 different cities, and we always get groups of between 40 and 50 people, and it's almost always experiencers. And I say that because these are people who've had a pretty significant sighting in their life.
Yeah.
It's few people that actually come just because they're curious.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of people who've had experiences.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks so much.
You're very welcome. Thanks. All right.
I'm with author and radio personality Mac Maloney. What's going on, Mac?
Nothing much today. Hot, humid day here in Newburyport, Mass, but that's no right. complaints.
You know, we're almost neighbors. You know, I actually work right down the road from where you live, so this is a nice, convenient podcast. Let's talk quickly about your radio show that you're on. You also have a once-a-month, it's called Encounters, but your weekly show, talk quickly about that.
Well, it's called Mac Maloney's Military X-Files Show. We're on at 7:30 to 9 o'clock Wednesday nights on kgraradio.com. And we talk about UFOs and the military. We have guests on every once in a while who are like Air Force fighter pilots, airline pilots, people who work for U.S. intelligence agencies. They come on and use pseudonyms, and they tell us the side of sighting UFOs that you don't normally hear. That is, as I say, from the military side of things, the intelligence side of things, airline pilots, sightings that you would never hear about out in the civilian world, let's say. Especially airline pilots will never report UFO sightings to their management, because it's definitely something that, you know, will be a hindrance when you're trying to get a promotion.
Have you ever had a pilot on?
Oh, yeah, we have pilots on all the time.
Wow, because I've tried to get a few pilots on, and I know I have some friends that are pilots, and they know people, but they won't come
right. on. They're very reluctant to do it, but it's only because I've known these people for a long time, and they know that, you know, we will keep their identity confidential. We alter their voices and
really?
Things like that. Right?
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, but they're fantastic sightings, but as I said, the problem is that with the military pilots, if you mention it, you're not going to get your next promotion. If you're an airline pilot, you do not want that on your in your dossier, let's say. And with the people who are connected with the intelligence services, of course, they're never going to. They might talk about it to their higher ups, but it's nothing we're ever going to learn about.
Yeah, and then you're on a monthly show, Encounters. Is that what that's called? Is Chase on that?
Yep,
Chase Klutzke. She's wonderful.
Oh yeah,
she's going to be back on our show in a little while.
She's the best. She is the one who got me into UFO radio in the first place, and Richard Dolan, Peter Robbins, and Race Hobbs. That's the five of us.
Yeah, all great people. Mm-hmm. Now, your book out now is called Beyond Area 51. Your last book was UFOs in Wartime. I read that, enjoyed that. I stuck my nose through this book as much as I could because I got it in the mail not that long ago. I'm a slow reader, by the way.
So am I.
But a fast writer. You write.
I write them. I don't know if it's fast. I write a lot. Let's put it that
way.
Yeah.
Now, I'm going to maybe criticize a little bit here, you know.
Great.
I was reading.
And
you're writing matter-of-factly, as in the Dulce Underground, that there's actually aliens eating human flesh?
You didn't get
I didn't get far enough.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
So is this hearsay type thing? I know we don't want to spoil too much of the book, but
It's I don't know if you can call it hearsay, because so many people believe it. You know, what happens in that chapter is that I write, you know, the first five pages or so, you know, taking all I did was Google Dulce Mountain and took anecdotes that I found, put them all together and wrote this story about what a lot of people think is going on. And the story is that there are 50,000 aliens living there, two different kinds of aliens. The U.S. government knows they're there. They're doing all these crazy experiments. They're turning men into octopus and gorillas into, you know, sharks and all this stuff. And there's been battles there. And the reason they're there is that they're going to take over the Earth. They're going to make us all zombies. And they're going to put us to work as slaves on their other bases on the Moon and on Mars.
I'm down with that. That's
me too. You know, it involves travel.
Yeah.
A lot of people believe this. There's been books written about it. There's been, you know, movies done. There are lectures done about it and so on and so forth. And it's complete nonsense, of course, but it's very interesting how it started. And it started by a gentleman who lived next to Kirtland Air Force Base.
Paul Benowitz.
Right, exactly.
Okay, so I was hoping you would, that's what I was going to bring up. Go ahead.
And how he stumbled upon two parallel running classified programs at Kirtland Air Force Base back in the 80s, having to do with nuclear weapon storage and the first test flights of pre-stealth airplanes. He thought that they were UFOs.
Yeah.
Monitoring nuclear storage facilities at Kirtland.
Which kind of makes sense.
Right.
Yeah.
And what he really stumbled upon was, these classified programs that were in place to keep those nukes away from prying eyes, those being Russian satellites going over. And he probably saw a few very early prototypes of stealth airplane. Well, instead of the Air Force kind of taking him in and just having him sign a security agreement, which thousands of people sign every year in the military and intelligence agencies, they chose to feed him all this incorrect information about what was going on in Dulce Mountain. And he believed them. He believed them. And he quite literally went insane.
Yeah.
It was an exercise in how to break a human being.
Right.
Very sad. Very sad story. Yeah. And one of the people who were in cahoots with the Air Force in doing this was like a fellow UFO community
Moore?
Member. Yeah, right.
Bill Moore.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, I have to say I'm relieved that you're telling me all this because I was reading that and I'm going, oh, my God, Mac believes.
Right. And now I have
Mac
to go
believes
talk
all
to
this.
Right. Yeah, no.
So, no, I'm glad you – no, that makes me – that's restored faith.
We ended on the that part of the chapter ends where someone said that if you eat chocolate, then the reptilians who are living in this mountain – I will leave you alone. So we should all start eating a lot of, Hershey bars or something. But then it just, then it says it's all nonsense. And of course it is. But, there's so many people who believe this is very strange in itself.
Now, you basically talk about these mysterious bases that actually do exist in different parts of the world. And again, I just skimmed through the book. I read the first part of the book, and then I just started skimming. So, can you talk a little bit about the basis all around?
Right. There's the genesis of the book came about many, many years ago. Someone I knew was in the Air Force, and they were stationed at Nellis Air Force Base, which is right outside of Las Vegas. Mm-hmm. And they would fly up to Area 51 on a fairly frequent basis, not to do any spook work, but just to fix airplanes that were flying out of there.
Mm-hmm.
But they were a little bit more on the inside than anyone that I had ever met. And I had said to them once, is Area 51 the only place out there like that? And my question was, are there Area 52s, 53s, 54s, so on and so forth? Now, you might not call them that, but he got the idea. And he says, sure. He says, there are other places out there in Nevada. There are other places around the country. There are other places around the world. And I just kind of kept that idea in my head. And when I had to do a follow-up book for UFOs in Wartime, and I had to present an idea to the publisher, I just came up with that idea. I said, let's write a book about Area 51 that isn't about Area 51, because Area 51 has been kind of done to death, nonfiction-wise, I think. So they said, okay, so that's what happened. So we just did a lot of research and found these, I think there are 16 places around the world that we found. They're not all military bases, but a lot of them are. But the unusual thing is that the vast majority of them have some kind of a UFO connection to them.
Hmm.
UFOs are, whatever UFOs are, and I don't think anyone really knows what they are, but whatever they are, they're attracted to these secret bases. Almost all of these secret bases, with two glaring exceptions, have a UFO history to them.
Now, would someone argue that those are secret military craft?
Well, they could be. There's a very good chance that they are. But some of them are, a couple of these bases don't have runways, let's say. They're not air bases. They're just bases, secret bases, especially in the UK. The chapter that we devote to Britain's Area 51 is really just a search looking for it. And luckily I had help from Nick Redfern and Nick Pope, where we just come up with like a top 10 of where England's Area 51 might be. And the place that we determine is called Rudlow Manor, and it's like an old English estate. It does not look like an air base at all. They all have that one thing in common, though. Some kind of UFO activity always seems to come along with the history of these places.
Well, going back to Dulce, I talked to Bill Burns. He was actually on my second podcast from UFO Hunters. And, they did a show on the Dulce base, and there was a weird half-human, half-cow thing. Did you happen to see that? But the thing is, when I was talking to him, he says something weird is going on there, and it's a weird area. And a lot of these places are just plain weird.
Plain weird is really a good description of a lot of these places. And, you know, I don't believe that there are 50,000 aliens inside this mountain. I mean, what would they be doing there? That's a lot, you know?
Well, that's like when someone says there's some people living inside of Venus. That'd be kind of dreary.
That would be dreary. Yeah. What are you doing all day, you know?
But knitting. Yeah.
That whole area is strange. And there are some strange stories about, you know, cattle mutilations and things that have been going on there. And people have seen, so many people have seen them that they can't be just not true. You know, helicopters landing and dropping off the remains of animals and stuff like that.
Well, you know, Benowitz was in that area to begin with about, because of cattle mutilations.
Right. Yep. Yeah. That was really the thread that that started him on you know, this this sad journey that he wound up taking.
Right, right. So you mentioned that most of these bases are military. Are there private entities as well?
In Britain, all of this stuff has been farmed out to private industry.
Uh-huh.
You know, and so of the top 10 suspected Area 51 locations in Britain, I think 8 of them are now under private. They're privately owned. One of them is by British Aerospace, BAE, for instance, runs at least one of them. But for the most part, like we do, we talk about ones in Russia. Obviously, the Russian military runs them. Pine Gap in Australia is jointly run by the U.S. and Australia. We talk about not quite a base in China, but this very odd setup that the Chinese military has in a place called Hangyangtang, in the middle of China. We talk a little bit about the Nazi bell of World War II.
Oh, yes.
We really kind of hopefully put a knife in that story forever.
And let's hear the knife.
Well, it's just one of these things that it started with one person's just outrageous claims that he saw files and papers by this SS colonel who claimed that they were building a, you know, take your pick. It's a time machine. It's some kind of a generator. It's something that a rocket ship could use as a propulsion unit. You name it. Everything that you can dream up, this thing was supposed to be. But if you really look into it, you find out that this person who made these claims never actually had the papers. There was no evidence at all that this SS colonel who was supposed to have generated these papers even had anything to do with anything other than running a death camp nearby. There's all kinds of stories about how the Nazis were in touch with these people on a planet way out, you know, several light years away, that they were taking instructions from them and getting technology from aliens and things. And the point that we make in the book, and we made it as well in UFOs in Wartime, is, you know, when you take this whole idea that the Nazis had UFOs and that they had, you know, people claim they have a secret base in Antarctica and that there's a base on the moon and so on and so forth. Well, if they had all this technology, this really way out technology for the 1940s, why did they lose the war?
Yeah, they would just take over the world.
They would just take over the world in a matter of, you know, days.
Yeah.
I mean, to create the atom bomb took 3-4 years. It took factories in 16 states. It took 500,000 people, and it took $25 billion. That's a lot of people. That's a lot of time. That's a lot of locations, and that's a lot of infrastructure. And when we, you know, defeated Germany, went into Germany, they found nothing even close to a setup like that that would have been needed if all these things were true.
Yeah. You know, it really here's two cases right here. We're talking, first of all, we talked about the Dulce Underground myth, and then about this one in particular. And it just goes to show that if enough people say it for long enough and write about it, it just gets almost passed off as fact.
Right. And that's why there's a chapter in the book about a place called Ong's Hat, which I'm sure you've never heard of.
Never heard of.
It's in the Pine Barrens in New Jersey.
Never heard of that.
Yeah, the Pine Barrens is this huge, forested, swampy section of New Jersey. It takes up a lot of the state of New Jersey, but very few people know it's there. No one lives there. The New Jersey Devil is from there, which is where the hockey team got its name. you know, the 95, Route 95 goes through it. Atlantic, the Atlantic City Highway goes through it. But it's the only way it's really become famous is that there was an episode of The Sopranos about the Pine Barrens. So anyway, there's this small town in the middle of it called Ong's Hat. It's been there for several hundred years. And the story was that these two twins, who were really far out thinking physicists, a boy and a girl, went to Princeton, got thrown out of Princeton because they were trying to sell a theory that called cognitive chaos, which that just through very, very simple manipulation of a person's body and a person's consciousness, they could go to other dimensions. And so they set up their camp, their laboratory at Ong's Hat in a trailer. And sure enough, they come upon how they can do this. And they get this little community and they send this one kid into another dimension and he comes back. And suddenly they're all traveling to different dimensions and stuff. And then when it got to the point where they were, you know, just basically interdimensional travelers, at the height of it, the Delta Force came in and burned down the place and killed them all. Okay, that's the story.
Now, I mean, is this...
Here's what we were just talking about. That was a story intentionally created by a guy named Joseph Matheny on the internet. What he was trying to do was he was trying to create the first myth on the World Wide Web. Okay, this is in the 80s now when, you know, it was still very new. And he and some of his cohorts got together and they started putting stories on all over, they called them e-zines back then, and bulletin boards. Hey, this is happening at Ong's Hat, New Jersey. This happened, this happened, this happened. And people started reading them, and then people started adding their own stuff to it. And so once again, it becomes like a huge game of telephone that kids would play where you whisper one thing, and by the time it comes around
the room, it's a whole different story.
It's a whole different story?
Yeah.
They intentionally did that, and it worked. And so what happens from that is, and that's why we put this chapter in, is that there's so many stories and so many myths in the UFO community, Dulcet Mountain being one, the Bell being another, where if people just keep telling them over and over again, in a way they become true. And we have a guy named Michael Kinsella who has written extensively about this, and he's quoted in the book. He says, that's how it is that, you know, if people just keep talking about things, they become true in a way.
Now, I know every time you and I talk, I bring this up. You're a Roswell non-believer.
Right.
So do you think it's the same thing?
Right. Yeah, I don't believe anything really happened at Roswell, though I believe it's another UFO myth. But it had a very interesting beginning, and that is that the Air Force actually put a headline out saying they had captured a flying disc. So, but what has happened is that story has been just retold so many times, probably more than any other UFO myth, if we can call it that. I mean, there's been many, many books written about it, movies, TV shows. I mean, and what's happening down there now, it's like a, it's like Carnival every day down there. You know, it's a tourist attraction.
Yes, I talked to someone that recently stopped in there, was telling me about it.
And it's, and even Jesse Marcel Jr., who we had on the show, great guy. He now lives up in Idaho or someplace up in the American Northwest. And he just didn't want to live there anymore. So I think that I think these stories that just keep on growing and growing and growing without any kind of verification of any quote-unquote facts, I think they started with Roswell, and I think there's been a number of them since. And I think Dulcet Mountain is one. I think the Bell is another one. And there are just many, many others. And I think these things, they cloud the real picture, the real UFO puzzle. And I think they actually detract from people who are doing, you know, real kind of research into figuring out what UFOs are. I think these things are a hindrance to it.
Yes. Now, I'm going to tell the listener, if you listen to this and you hear me not arguing about Roswell, you can go back and listen to Mac Maloney. I argued with him back then. We don't have to rehash it now.
That's right.
Yeah.
Right.
So there's, on Chapter 13, the case of Saddam's Area 51. Can you talk about that?
Mm-hmm. You know, once again, this is a story that we got from Russian sources, which are always interesting.
This sounds really intriguing, Russian sources.
Right. There was a story that was kicking around, and we had it in UFOs in Wartime, that there were a number of UFO incidents during the first Gulf War. And this is during when in UFOs in wartime, the case we try to make is that UFOs are seen more in wartime than in peacetime.
Yes.
And so there were a number of UFO incidents over the Gulf, especially in the 6 months leading up to the Gulf War, after Saddam had invaded Kuwait. And especially during the war itself, we had stories about UFOs being intercepted by planes on their way to bomb Baghdad and so on. But there was this one story that kept coming up saying that in that time between the first Gulf War and the invasion of Iraq in 2003, that Saddam's anti-aircraft forces shot down a UFO and recovered it and then brought it to this place whose name I'm not even going to try to pronounce, but a secret base that people were calling Saddam's Area 51. Inside this place, and once again, these kind of Russian sources wrote about this in Pravda, the claim was that they reverse engineered some technology found on this UFO and turned it into a weapon of mass destruction. There's also a story that there was some kind of a weapon there that shot at the Challenger space shuttle, the one that crashed, mm-hmm. the most recent one years ago. And that did have an Israeli pilot on it. In fact, that Israeli pilot was one of the pilots who was in on the bombing of a Iraqi nuclear reactor in the early 80s. So once again, these are maybe threads that are more dotted lines than anything, but there was
sort
these
sort of like conspiracies.
Yeah, theories. Conspiracy theories. And I mean, and, mm-hmm. and you know, would the Iraqis really have a weapon like this? But on the other hand, when you really look at what happened in the Iraqi invasion, they were supposed to have gone in there to look for nuclear weapons, biological weapons, chemical weapons. They didn't find any of that stuff. So,
yeah,
there were some people say, well, what they were really looking for was this WMD that had been reverse engineered from a UFO. It's a fantastic story. You know, with writing of any book, you want it to be entertaining. And there are several stories in there that said they were just too good not to include. You know, did George Bush send, 200,000 U.S. troops into Iraq to try to get some kind of a weapon of mass destruction that was re-engineered from a UFO? Probably not. Yep. But, you know, I mean, the explanation he gave us didn't work either. So
yeah.
I suppose anything's possible.
Through all the different research that you did for this book, was there anything that was really super compelling to you? What was your most interesting part?
The most interesting place that we looked into is a place called the M Triangle in Russia. And not many people know about this place. And it's also called the Perm Anomalous Zone. It's, as I say, near the Ural Mountains. It's 40 square miles, mostly heavily forested. But there are some kind of valleys and meadows. And it actually looks like this kind of heavenly place.
Hmm.
Well, in the old Soviet Union, people were not allowed to go into this place. And the villages, the people who live in villages close by, there's not many of them, but this place was always thought of as like kind of like a haunted forest, and people would not go in there. The only people who were going in there during the Soviet years were the KGB. When the Soviet Union fell and this slightly more liberal Russian government took place, they did start allowing journalists and researchers into the M Triangle. And what they found was, first of all, UFOs sighted there almost every day and heavily documented. But it was even more than that. I mean, there were stories about encounters with, you know, ETs. The animals there have no fear of humans. The fish will come right up to you if you're, like, wading in a stream or something. But there's also things like it's hard to light a match there without it exploding. People are camping out in, as I say, a heavily forested area, and they hear traffic going by. They hear people speaking. They've recorded these things. Hear like a ghostly choir. You can't make a phone call anywhere in the M Triangle except in this one place that's 5x5 that they call the call box. And if you're standing in that with your cell phone, you can make a phone call to anywhere in the world.
What do you mean 5x5?
5 feet by 5 feet. I don't know how they found it, but they did.
Was any of this verifiable?
Well, there's a lot of Russian research has been written about it. And there are a number of researchers over there who go in there all the time. Hmm. They bring groups of people in there and they stay for 1 or 2 weeks. People magazine did a big story on
really?
It in the 80s.
Wow. Yeah.
And the either ancient aliens or the UFO hunters went there. Uh-huh. But the strange thing about this place is, and we are relying on mostly Russian research, but it just seems to be so much of it that some of it has to be true.
Yeah. And it almost sounds like you were talking earlier about, you know, interdimensional. It almost sounds like another dimension right there when you hear traffic and people talking.
Right.
Yeah, that's bizarre.
People have gone in there with diseases and come out cured. The Russians say when you go in there, when you come out, you have a new soul, is how they put it. You come out like a different person and, you know, happier and, you know, whatever. But there's this one incident where, and this is what the People magazine article really zoomed in on this, was this gentleman whose name is so Russian, I'm not even going to try to pronounce it. He was he was washed out of the Soviet military for medical reasons. He was unemployed for a while. He became a journalist. And right around this time, they started letting people into the M Triangle. He got an assignment to go in as a journalist and join one of these groups that stay in there for a couple of weeks. He did this. He came out, went back to Moscow, started writing a story, and suddenly found himself filled with knowledge of astrophysics, of astronomy, of just plain ordinary physics. He had never had any training in this before. Yeah. And within a year and a half, he was a cosmonaut. And all of this, you know.
Did they have one-way tickets there?
Yeah, I know.
Open a resort there.
Yeah, I know. I'm surprised that there isn't Disneyland there. But, you know, this guy is actually, you know, he's kind of living proof that, I guess, that very strange things happen in this place. People call it a little piece of heaven on earth. And just when you read about it, when you see pictures of it, you know, it looks very kind of pastoral, just kind of heavenly in a way, you know?
Mm-hmm. Now, is it occupied by anyone?
No, it's just barren land. As I say, a lot of forest, but a lot of kind of meadows and valleys and nice and, you know, rivers running through it and everything. No one lives there. No one's ever lived there. Why this place is like that, no one really knows. I mean, there's stories that there might have been some kind of a secret base there. The KGB, like I say, were the only people who were allowed in there before the Soviet Union fell. And now the present-day KGB is called the FSB, the Federal Service Bureau, I think they call it, the modern-day KGB. They're always hanging around there. But there is access there. I would love to go there just to see what is really going on.
Road trip.
Really?
Yeah.
But everyone who goes there seems to come out changed in some way. And for the most part, the better. It's just a very strange place. And of all the places in the book, that's the one that had, you know, the most kind of effect on me.
Yeah, I'm gonna skip to that chapter tonight. Yeah. Now, you talk a little bit about I guess I could call it a myth, more or less. The underground basis for USOs. Do you talk about that?
Mm-hmm.
And that means unidentified submersible object. Is that exactly?
Submerged objects.
Submerged, yeah, okay.
The U.S. Navy has their own Area 51. It's called AUTEC, AUTEC.
Is it off Florida?
It's in the Bahamas. It has two locations. One of them is on the eastern coast of Florida, and then one of them, the major installation, is on Andros Island in the Bahamas, which just happens to be right in the middle of the Bermuda Triangle. So the U.S. Navy built their secret base in the middle of the Bermuda Triangle, which I think is awesome and odd at the same time. And what they do there is what they say they do is right next to it is a thing called the Tongue of the Ocean, TOTO. And it's a deep trench. It goes down quite far. And they bring their nuclear submarines there, whether they've just been launched or if they have new equipment put on. And they basically go down. It's a place where they can go down very, very deep and monitor what's going on with the submarines. Mm. Okay. And that's what they do there. There's no doubt about it. However, they have billions of dollars worth of monitoring equipment there for both under the ocean and in the skies. They have radar systems there that can see hundreds and hundreds of miles out and hundreds of, you know, 100 or so miles up. Mm-hmm. At the same time, there are dozens of, probably hundreds of UFO reports coming from that area over the years, UFO reports and USO reports. I mean,
from civilians, obviously.
From civilians,
yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, reported in newspapers and so on. And it's almost like an everyday occurrence down there. And people who are civilian workers at RTEC have reported these things as well. Hmm. So here's the question that we have in the chapter is, on one hand, the Navy says, well, it's just a coincidence that we built this secret base in the middle of the Bermuda Triangle. Yes, we have billions of dollars worth of this monitoring equipment. We can see things coming in the air from hundreds of miles away. We know what's going on in the ocean hundreds of miles around us. But we don't know anything about UFOs and USOs. So that either tells you one of two things. Either all this billions and billions of dollars of equipment they have down there doesn't work.
Yeah.
Or they're lying.
Yeah. What do you think?
I think they're lying.
Yeah.
I think, you know, this stuff that they have, if they can see every inch of ocean between literally Bermuda and Puerto Rico.
Yeah.
And if people are seeing UFOs coming out of the water, and we have some really fantastic stories in there, you know, yeah. of things in the water and then coming out of the water and taking off like a conventional UFO, if they don't know that stuff is going on, you know, they should really check for the check back with the manufacturer of all that monitoring equipment because it's not working.
Yeah.
It's a very interesting place, a highly secret place. I was able to talk to someone because I know a few people who work in the intelligence community, and I was actually able to talk to someone on the phone who had just been there.
Oh.
An RTEC on Andros Island, and he says that it's very odd because it's not what you think it's going to be. He says you drive, especially in this part of the Bahamas, everyone thinks the Bahamas is what you see, you know, in the travel brochure.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a lot of it is third world. He says mm-hmm. you just drive through these third world villages in just poor conditions, and then suddenly you come upon this fantastic Navy base out in the middle of nowhere.
Wow.
And he says there's huge cables that go down into the water. There's all kinds of these satellite dishes and everything. And it's just a very interesting place. It's the Navy's Area 51. A lot of people like to call it that. And I think the Navy kind of gets a free ride when it comes to UFOs because any kind of UFO military connection in this country always goes right, falls into the lap of the Air Force.
Yep.
But the Navy themselves, you know, they have a lot of UFO files that they have not released going back to World War II. So they kind of get a pass. And again,
yeah,
I just
no one ever really talks about the Navy, do they?
No. And no one ever really kind of takes them to task about it. And they should, but so far,
maybe
no one
this
has.
Is the beginning right here.
Okay.
Your book and this podcast. Yeah.
Perfect.
I think the third largest listening audience we have is in Australia. And you do a little bit about Australia. Can you talk about that?
Yep, Australia has a really different breed of UFOs. We start out the chapter with this, talking about this place called the Nullarbor Plain. And what that is it's a desert that stretches from south central Australia over to western Australia. And there's a highway that goes through it. It's like about 1,000 miles long. It's the longest, straightest highway in the world.
Wow.
It goes right through this desert. So many UFOs have attacked motorists on this highway that they actually put up a sign saying, you know, driving on this highway may be hazardous to your health because of your UFO activity.
So what do you mean by attacked?
Well, the one instance that we have in the book tells the story of this family who they're driving from the western part of Australia and on the Nullarbor Plain highway. And a lot of people do it at night because it gets brutally hot there during the day. And they were driving along. It was a mother and three of her grown sons. And they see a light coming towards them. And they just think that it's a truck, let's say, coming in the other direction. But then they realize that it's a single light, and it's in their lane.
Hmm.
And they swerve out of the way. The thing goes right over the top of them. They turn around. They go 180 degrees. And now it's in front of them again. They do 180 degrees again, and it's in front of them again, and it starts chasing them. So now they're frantic, and they're you know, barreling down this highway, going very fast, and they hear something land on the roof of the car. And one of them reached up to see what was happening, and when they pulled their hand back in the car, it was just covered with this black soot. The next thing they know, the car started to lift up off the highway and was dropped. And that caused, I think, one or two of the tires to pop, and the car gets in an accident and goes off the side of the road. Wow. Now, they get out, and they hide, and they see this UFO. It was a UFO going, kind of studying the car for a little while, and then they take off. The UFO takes off. They stayed there for a long time until they finally somehow they repaired the car and made it to the next town. The law enforcement came out, and everything that these people said happened, the evidence looked like it happened, because you could see the tire tracks spinning and so on and so forth. You could see where the car went off the road.
What about the residue in the top of the car?
I think that was gone. That it also came with a really odd smell, too. They said it was a very disturbing smell. So when the law enforcement people put that together with the fact that there had been so many other instances of people reporting similar things, that for whatever reason, UFOs seem to attack motorists on this highway. So we got into that a little deeper, and once again with the help of Nick Redfern, and he told us that what happened was back in the early 50s, the British needed a place to start their atomic bomb testing. There was no place in England to do it because England is, you know, fairly crowded place. Mm-hmm. So they went down to Australia, and they actually took land from the native Aborigines, took over some of their sacred land and started lighting off nukes on it.
That's pretty nice.
At a place called Woomera. And as soon as that started happening, UFOs started showing up in abundance. And all this time that this Woomera test facility was open, they had numerous UFO incidents, power going out, UFOs flying around where the bombs were going to go off. Once again, a lot of this documented. And for whatever reason, this started this whole idea that UFOs in Australia aren't, like, we think of them, at least in this country, as being kind of benign, you know,
sure.
Kind of observers. You know,
yeah.
They never really interact with us very much, and certainly yeah. not in this, you know, in any kind of a negative manner. But in Australia, they do.
Again, never knew that.
Yeah, for whatever reason. So now we're at this place that is literally in the center of Australia called Pine Gap. And it's this massive facility that the U.S. built there, the National Security Agency built there.
Really? Never heard of that. Yeah.
Oh. CIA runs it. Dead center of the country.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a huge listening post. They listen in on other people's satellite transmissions. They listen in on phone calls. I mean, this latest controversy with the NSA, where they're listening and have the ability to listen in on anyone they want, which
yes.
is different from listening in on everybody. They
yeah.
can listen in on anyone they want, but they're not listening in on all of us. They have an algorithm where they can go through billions of phone calls in a matter of seconds, and they look for key words and phrases.
Yeah.
And if one pops up, then they're going to listen in on you. This is one of the places that they do that. They also monitor space flights there. They monitor other countries' space launches. And it's just this massive facility out in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah, because it's, you know, Australia's populated along the coast, but
right.
in the center, wow.
And it has, you know, these really fantastic UFO anecdotes come from this place. In fact, the one we have in the book was this incident that was witnessed by five people who, if you've ever seen the movie Close Encounters of the
oh, yeah.
Third Kind, at the end where the spaceship comes down and there's interaction between the ETs and the humans, it's almost a rewrite of that movie. All you need is John Williams' music, you know, in the background. But the interesting thing was that there was a prior incident that someone witnessed that came out long before the movie, which is close in that detail as well. Lots of UFOs seen coming in and out of the mountains there. A lot of people believe that, in this case, that these UFOs are actually man-made flying objects. You know, they seem to be in concert with the people who are running Pine Gap. There's a very small village nearby called Alice Springs, and the people there see UFOs all the time as well. The government, the Australian government, there was one UFO encounter out there that was so vivid that the Australian government, which apparently has its own TV channel there, said, we're going to look into this and we're going to tell you exactly what happened there. And then they never mentioned it again.
Yeah.
And the Australian military, quote unquote, lost a lot of their UFO files a few years ago. So Australia has a different breed of UFOs. It's very strange. Interesting, though.
Yeah. We're getting near the end of our time here. Do you want to talk a little bit about any of your other books?
Well, as it turned out, I was able to write two Area 51-related books almost at the same time.
You mean another one in addition to this?
Mm-hmm.
Is it out?
Yes, it is, right.
Okay.
But I have to explain a little bit. When I first started writing in the 80s, the first thing I did, I had this men's action adventure series called Wingman. It was about a Zen
yeah.
fighter pilot. And that's really how I kind of made my bones in the writing business. And we sold 1 million copies between 1987 and 1999, 16 original books. And then I went on to other things. Well, ever since then, people have been writing to me and emailing me and saying, when are you going to start this series up again? So as I was finishing Beyond Area 51, another publisher got involved and wanted to revive the Wingman series. So they said, well, look, we're going to release all the original books as ebooks and then as original paperbacks later on this year. But do you want to write a new Wingman adventure to kind of start it up again? And so I said, sure. And they said, well, you can just, you know, pick whatever plot you want, whatever. And I said, well, why not have them go to Area 51? I have all this Area 51 research laying around. So I was able to kind of take the research that I had done for Beyond Area 51 and just created this, you know, it's Wingman is Mad Max in a jet fighter. That's how it's described. And he's this kind of superhero fighter pilot. But, you know, going to Area 51, you know, adds that kind of mystery of the UFOs and everything.
Sure.
So everything, all the fantastic things that I didn't put in this book, I managed to put in this book called Attack on Area 51. And it's a $2 download from Amazon.com. You know, it's a lot of people like it. You know, it's kind of like a lot of fun. It's not really serious, but it's been able to, it succeeded in reviving the whole Wingman series again. So
great.
Something I've always I've wanted to do for the past 15 years. So
yeah, I actually saw something on Facebook about that. You wrote on that. The person you met with, you initially talked about the spook, I guess. Mm-hmm. Now, what was the last meeting with him after all this?
Okay. Well, yeah, there's a person who is in beyond Area 51. A friend of mine who works for the intelligence agency, someone I've known since grade school. And someone says he follows you around in the book like Marley's ghost, you know, like in Christmas Carol. Not quite, but he did read sections of the book as I was writing them. And all I said to him was in our initial meeting, which is the beginning of the book, if you see me straying too far off, just let me know.
Yeah.
And he said, fine. So we meet at the end of the book too, at a bar in close to Boston. And he brings me to a place that I'm not going to identify. I think it's best left as the punchline of the book. He brings me to a very surprising place, and he says that, you know, there are these secret bases everywhere, but if they want to hide something, they hide it in plain sight. And he makes the case that if you really have something that's just super, super duper secret, you don't hide it at Area 51 or any of these places. You hide it in plain sight. And the place where we were sitting, he just kind of spread his arms out and he says, in fact, they could just hide it here. And when he said it, I couldn't quite believe it, but you have to really buy the book to see where we are. But it's a very surprising place.
Wow. Yeah. That's a good teaser. That'll get someone to buy this book. To announce one more time, you will be a guest star on our forum from July 20th to July 23rd. And that means that anyone can join the forum and interact with questions about this podcast or about anything else that Mac Maloney has been involved with in the past. Thanks so much.
Thanks. Really looking forward to that. Thank you.
So that's it for our show today. Don't forget to check out our website, which is podcastufo.com. You can check out all the articles and blogs we have there, past episodes of our podcast, as well as our forum, Facebook page, and more. Please check it out. Don't forget, you can listen to us first live on allinonebroadcast.com. Every Friday night at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, you can join us in the chat room, and that is 12 Greenwich Mean Time. See you next week, and don't forget to keep your eyes to the sky and your curiosity high.